Hello and welcome to episode 61 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Perry Middlemiss. Now, I have a question for you, Perry.
Oh, yes.
Are you a librocubicularist?
Somebody who reads in bed?
Exactly. Well done. You must have better Latin than I have. Very
no,
good.
No, I think I might have seen that one. No.
You're not. You don't read in bed.
I don't read in bed. My wife does all the time, in the morning and in the evening. I don't like it. I just don't feel comfortable there. I like to... These days, I've actually got to the point where I'm really missing a really solidly decent armchair with good arms up on the side. Because I like to be able to hold the book or the reading device, whatever it is. I like to have it sort of propped up now so that I can sit and it's holding it in a good spot. And I need to be able to get the light on it because some of us are getting a bit older, David. Our eyes are not doing exactly well. And as you remember, a little while ago, I mentioned with some of those old paperbacks that are starting to look a bit brown and tan.
Tiny print and brown.
And the tiny print. God, you know, font sizes of about 7 or 8.
Yeah, that's right. We used to be able to read those.
Yeah, that used to be a piece of cake. Now, struggle. So I can read it during the daylight with a light, bright sunshine or a bright light, but no. So, no, I'm not a big one for reading in bed. What about you?
Well, it's interesting because we have a long-standing tradition now of reading a book out loud at night before we go to sleep.
Oh, okay.
So I'm generally the one who does the reading, although sometimes my wife takes over. But that's good. It kind of relaxes you before you go to bed. And
So
we're currently reading Piranesi for me the third time, but for her the first time. So she's finding it interesting but very puzzling, as you do at the start.
Good.
That's what you want.
Yeah, exactly what you want. I think it is a puzzling book, and I think it's good that people get puzzled by it and then try and figure it all out, which is why you've got to be very careful about what you say about it.
Indeed.
So in some ways I think that's what I'm also discovering in all of this, that... if you come across a book where you're a bit dubious about telling too much of the plot, it means that there's something there that the reader is going to pick up on and going to enjoy, and you don't want to ruin that enjoyment for them.
Very true.
And so that's why if people say, well, why don't you tell us more about what's going on? No. If we think that, you know, you need to know, then we'll tell you. But if we think that it's probably better for you not to know, well, then I'm sorry, but we're not going to tell you. You're going to have to find that out for yourself.
Indeed.
Which I think is the best thing.
All right. Well, moving on, I believe you have some sad news for us.
Yes, I do have some sad news. A friend of mine and an acquaintance of yours, I believe, Australian science fiction fan Judith Hannah, died during this past week. I knew that she was unwell earlier in the year, but I thought that her treatment had worked well. But unfortunately, there was a remission and she went downhill very quickly, which is very, very sad. Judith was originally born in New South Wales, moved around with her father until they finally settled, probably when she was in her early teens in Western Australia, and she ended up going to the University of Western Australia and studying there and then moved back to Sydney. And that's when she met her future partner, Joseph Nicholas. Now, Joseph was travelling out to Australia from the United Kingdom as the Guff winner, which is the Get Up and Under fan fund winners. Now, we haven't really spoken much about fan funds on this podcast as yet, but we should do that at some point.
Yes, worth discussing it.
We had a bit of an idea about people. We might have talk to Mr. Edmonds about that, seeing as he was the first from our side.
He was a Duff winner, yes.
Yes, he was a Duff winner going over to the US from Australia. Guff takes people from Australasia, because I shouldn't say just Australia, so Australasia into Europe. And Joseph was the Guff candidate in 1981, and he attended Adventure 81, which happens to be a first major national convention that I worked on in 1981. And he met Judith on that trip. She subsequently moved over there to live with him. They got married. And unfortunately, she's just passed away in this last week. Joseph has written a obituary of her, which has been published in The Guardian. So she was well known in terms of environmental issues and societies in the UK. She also worked on a lot of public transport work. And it was an all-round nice person. I got to know her a lot better when my wife and I moved to London for a couple of years in the early 90s and saw them a lot more often than I had in the past. But she's a great loss.
Indeed. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes to that that obituary, which is very well worth reading.
I think it is, yes. Thank you.
Indeed. All right, other news we'll move on to. I've just mentioned Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, which is up for this year's Hugo Award, but it has just won the Women's Prize for Fiction. The Women's Prize for Fiction is one of the United Kingdom's most prestigious literary prizes. It's awarded annually to a female author of any nationality for the best original full-length novel written in English and published in the United Kingdom in the preceding year. I'm quoting out of Wikipedia there, of course.
Was it originally called the Orange Prize?
It was originally called the Orange Prize.
Yeah, there's been at least one, or Kate Grenville won it once, I believe. Not sure, Australian author. I'm not sure there's any other Australian authors that have won it, but it is a very prestigious prize. Yes.
Sure. And the other things worth mentioning about Piranesi and Susanna Clarke is that there's what I thought was a really interesting interview between her and Neil Gaiman, which I actually got up at a crack of dawn to listen to. In fact, before the crack of dawn to listen to at 4:30 in the morning, which, of course, it was in 7:30 in England, only to discover later on that there's a recording of the damn thing on YouTube afterwards, so I could have just watched the recording. Never mind, it was well worth being there, watching it live.
Always better live, always better.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting interview. What else have we got new? You have some news about anniversary of someone?
Yes, it was the 100th anniversary of the birth yesterday, that is the, as we speak, so that would be the 12th of September, so the 100th anniversary of the birth of Stanisław Lem,
yeah.
The Polish science fiction writer, who was in his time very scathing about American science fiction. Said that it was basically hopeless with a few exceptions, the major one of those being Philip K. Dick, who he thought was pretty good. We spoke a bit about Lem last year when we were talking about Solaris, the two film adaptations of his novel. That was an interesting thing to discuss, and it was his 100th birthday yesterday. And there's another big anniversary that you picked out that I didn't know about, David.
Yes, this is courtesy of the State Library of Victoria, who are holding a special exhibition about it. But yes, it's the 700th anniversary of the death of Dante Alighieri, the author of The Divine Comedy, Inferno, Purgatory and Paradiso. So that's interesting for those who are interested in such matters.
Well, yes, I mean, there's been a lot of... his work has had a lot of influence on science fiction.
Indeed.
His versions of Hell, for example, were picked up and run with by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle in their novel Inferno, and the sequel, the title of which escapes me.
But no, I can't remember the sequel.
Probably Inferno Revisited or something along those lines.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Let's hope they work their way up to Purgatory, but anyway, we'll see.
So that was interesting.
There we are.
So what else have you been up to, David?
Well, this is one of the things we thought we would talk about on this particular episode of the podcast, and that's some of the things we've been doing outside the podcast. We don't we're not very good at self-promotion. Well, at least I'm not. And so we thought it might be useful to sort of talk about some of these external projects we're working on to have a chat about those. So, Perry, I wanted to talk to you about your relatively new fanzine. It's only had two issues so far this year, the Ellen Review. Now, what made you decide to start publishing a fanzine again, a general purpose fanzine again?
Well, it sort of all started because I was finding there were some things that I wanted to write about and comment on inside the science fiction world that was going to be at greater length than what I had currently available. So I wrote a... it's all based pretty much on the discussions that we've had, David. One of them was the Hugo Time Machine, and I was quite taken with the SF novels of, I think it was 1960, the one, the Canticle for Leibowitz, and I thought that was a pretty good year. And I sat down and I thought, well, I've read all of the novels in that particular year. I should actually write a piece about it and put all of them together and compare them to see whether they actually came up with the right idea, you know, the right answer in terms of who was the winner in that particular year. So I wrote that piece up and gave it off to our friend Bruce Gillespie for his fanzine science fiction commentary. And then I thought, oh, that's interesting. I enjoyed doing that. I thought that was, you know, quite good. It was enjoyable and enlightening. And I thought, well, I might do a few more of these. So I queried him and asked him about it. And he said, communication lines got a little bit crossed. And I think he misunderstood what I was talking about. And I misunderstood his response. This is all done by email, of course. And, you know, you have basically, it's pretty easy to mess it up if you're not really terribly careful.
Absolutely.
Now, there's nothing nasty about it. It was just that he said one thing and I thought he meant another. And I said one thing and he thought I meant another. And as it worked out, he said, well, no, he wasn't interested in them, but it was that he wasn't interested in doing the reviews. And he thought I'd suggested that he do the reviews and was, nah, that wasn't what I was talking about. I was talking about what I wanted to do. So I thought, well, I've got a couple of ideas for what I wanted to do. And the first one in particular was I wanted to have a look at all of the science fiction and fantasy award winners of 2020. So that would have been all of the novels that were that won the major awards, 7 or 8 major awards in that were first published in 2019. And so I started putting that together, and then I thought, I'll see if I can find anywhere to put it. And I went hunting around, and the fanzine world has changed since we were in it 25, 30 years ago to a great degree, David.
Probably a good thing too.
Well, probably is a good thing, but what it basically meant was I couldn't find anywhere to submit this thing. There might have been one or two places, but I just didn't really know about it, couldn't find them. And then I thought, oh, well, that's it. Might as well publish my own. And so I know that you and I had a lot of discussion about what we were going to call the thing. I was originally thinking that I might call it the Alien Review of Books, which was going to be a sort of a take on the, you know, sort of the New York Times, the review of books and all that sort of stuff. But and then I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't do that because I'm not really going to restrict it purely to books. I'm going to be dealing about it with other things as well. And so I just decided to call it the Alien Review or something like that. And so I did a bit of a search and couldn't find anybody that ever written that had published a fanzine called The Alien Review. There was The Alien Critic that Richard E. Guise published back in the 1970s, which won one or two or three Hugos, I'm not sure how many. And oddly enough, that was one of the very first fanzines I ever picked up in January 1975 from the late lamented Space Age Books when I passed through Melbourne on the way through to Tasmania. A few friends of mine and I were going over to do a bit of bushwalking and hitchhiking around Tasmania, which you could do at that stage without too much trouble, and dropped into Space Age Books, picked this up and read that, thought it was pretty good. That sort of kicked me off on fanzine fandom way back then, and so decided that this would be a good thing to do and started putting some information, starting putting some articles together, things that I was writing, and then I thought, what else do I want to have in this? And then I thought, well, it really should. And I'm of this view. I think that a publication like a fanzine, personal zine, or a genzine, which is a general distribution fanzine, should really reflect the personality and the interests of the person that's actually editing and producing it. So I wanted to talk about some of the things that we had discussed on the podcast And so for each of the two issues that we've put out so far and scheduled for the third one as well, there's a transcription of one discussion that either you and I have had or no. Actually, it's not. We haven't. Oh no, that's the ones coming up. The first issue has myself and Chong talking about ghost species.
Yeah, which is very interesting. Mm.
And the second issue has you and Lucy Sussex talking about the sunken land begins to rise again. Yep. Not quite as interesting, David, but still, it's okay. No. It is actually very interesting, that one. And the schedule for the next one is going to be the discussion we had regarding Solaris and the science fiction films from last year.
Okay, good.
And so basically I wanted to put those in with that sort of stuff. So some of the things that we were talking about, to do transcriptions of those, some reviews of other fanzines, which Erwin Hirsch did for my first issue, but he's in the process of packing up his house to try and move later in the year. So he's not really in a spot where he can spend a lot of time doing that. That sort of thing, but also some reprints of some old fanish material, and some articles or reviews from certain other people.
Like me, for example, like you, David. Yeah.
And so that's where it went. And so then I wrote a very large piece for the second issue about short SF in 1965, and I did a reevaluation of that, which is a very strange and weird thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, there was some really interesting stuff there, because we covered a fair bit of it in the Hugo Time Machine for the 1966 Hugos a while back.
Mm.
And that got me thinking about a whole lot of things that were going on there. And that was a long piece of work. From the time I started that until I actually finished the piece, probably took me 3 months of working on and off, doing the writing, making the notes, putting it all together, coming up with some conclusions at the end. But I'm a retired gentleman. Most of the time we're in lockdown. Most of the time I'm not allowed to go out anywhere. And so you might as well be sitting at home doing something that you really enjoy. And
that's
I do enjoy this sort of stuff.
That's right.
And I've also had the added bonus, David, that you're very good at design and layout.
Thank you.
I'm very grateful that you've actually helped me to put this thing together and to write the pieces like the appreciation of Shirley Jackson that you wrote for me for the second issue.
Which is
quite excellent. Mm.
It's just been
a good, interesting exercise putting it all together, trying to get all the stuff in, continuously thinking about what I'm going to be putting together for issues 3 and 4, which I'm working on at the moment. 3 mostly, of course, because that one's the next one, and 4, which will be coming up in the beginning of next year sometime. So it's
quarterly, isn't it? You're planning to make it roughly quarterly.
I mean, I don't take subscriptions for this. I'm not taking any money, so I don't feel beholden to anybody to get it out at a certain time, although I've got a sort of feeling within my own head that that's really the schedule that I want to run to. But it all depends on the other things that you and I are doing, David. You know, sort of like you're doing some other things, including being the official editor of Ranzapper, which takes some of your time each 2 months.
If
the schedule happens to overlap, it makes it pretty difficult for you to actually finish the work on my thing. If you've got the other one that's there, that's a very definite commitment for it to come out at a certain time every 2 months.
Yes, what we don't want is the meeting of three tides where I've got the Zappa weekend, I've got the Alien Review to design, and I've got the podcast to do. You know, that would be.
We had that last time. And we thought, So we just pushed it back by 2 or 3 weeks because there just wasn't any point trying to. too many square pegs trying to get into the one round hole, and it wasn't going to fit.
Yeah.
And in the end, we just decided that it was better that we put it off for a couple of weeks. I didn't hear too very many people complaining, by the way, David. So I don't think anybody noticed. So that was a good thing.
Sure. Now you're not printing any copies of this. This is all still PDF.
No, that's right.
You looked at printing it, but it was going to cost way too much. Is that right?
Oh, they're about $8 an issue. I mean, we're talking 48 pages. Mm. They're going to cost about $7 or $8 an issue to print. And postage to the US, for example, it's like about $12 to $14. It was going to cost me $22 to land a copy of this on somebody's desk in the UK, in the US, probably similar to the UK, if you can get it there, because there's lots of stories about how the postal service going into the US is not working very well at the moment. I'm expecting copies of a magazine. I've actually got a subscription to the New York Review of Books, and I reckon I've got three, if not four, issues of a fortnightly newspaper magazine that have not arrived yet.
Mm.
So the postage is really slow. I mean, people are talking about the Australia Post being up against it with a lot of parcels that they can't deliver because there's such a backlog. So in the end, I just decided that, well, we're in an age of electronic distribution, so why not just go for a straight PDF? If people want to be able to get a copy of it, they can get it, and then they can print it themselves if that's what they want. I know Bruce Gillespie, for one, does that. And there are a couple of people in the US who have told me they do that. So happy if that happens. I just can't afford to do it myself, being retired gent on a limited income. It's just not viable to be able to do that at all.
So where can people get it then, Perry?
Well, you can get it through the good graces of a gentleman by the name of Bill Burns, who runs a website called efanzines.org, which we'll put a link on. There's a whole heap of... put this way, it's the best site for you to be able to go and get access to all of the fanzines that are around at the moment, or at least the ones that are sending them through to Bill for him to load up onto his server. And he loads two or three new ones up every week, and you can download them, have a look at them, and then get into the community by writing letters to the people that have produced them and ask to be put onto their straight mailing list, so you'll get them before they appear on eFanzine. So it's not an automatic thing. You send it through to Bill, and then Bill has to load it. Now, sometimes it'll be done that day, but sometimes it might take anything up to a week if he's just put a couple up, because he only does it in his spare time as well. And so there may be a lag between when you actually send your fanzine to him and it appears on eFanzines, but it's a very short lag and nobody notices and nobody cares. But if you want to get it quicker, you can always get in contact with the editor and ask to be put on their list. If it's like mine and it comes out as a PDF, there's no postage for me. I mean, I just basically send it out and people get it, and that's it. So it's been a good and interesting exercise. It really helps me. It gives me goals for things to work towards. I know that I've got to be able to do this amount of reading, not just for the podcast. And you see, I also can meld the two by having the reading for the podcast as well as for this particular fanzine if I'm going to be writing reviews for it. So some of the things that will turn up in the Alien Review will be things that people have already heard us speaking about here on the podcast, but it will be expanded and it won't be so all over the shop like I normally am when we're talking about something, and hopefully might have a little bit more direction and purpose to it. So that's what I'm working on, David, but I mentioned earlier on that you are the official editor of Anzapper, which is one of your major things that you do, but you've got some other things ticking along in the background as well.
Well, based on a similar impulse to you, I've gone in the other direction in a way. The impulse is that I've been writing book reviews, or little summary book reviews for Anzapper for forever, really, almost, going way, way back. I've always had a little section called Recent Reading. I've been publishing those for a long while in Ann Zappa. And since we started running the podcast, I've really been taking the notes I write for the podcast and putting those through Ann Zappa. But Ann Zappa is a very limited audience. There's only 25 or so people in Ann Zappa at any one time. And so...
Room for more members.
Well, there is definitely room for a few more members at least. So it really occurred to me that because I'm reading stuff and I'm writing these reviews for the podcast or for Ann Zappa, there might be an audience for that outside of those two things. Some people don't want to listen to podcasts. And a lot of people, of course, are not in Ann Zappa. So it occurred to me that there might be an audience for this kind of thing. But rather than go the quarterly route that you've gone, I've gone in the other direction. You've gone quarterly and have very long, long and detailed articles. I've gone the opposite direction and I've gone fortnightly have shorter reviews. So I've got a thing that I call Through the Biblioscope, and that's run on Substack, the Substack platform at the moment. And so far, I'm up to four issues, and so far I've managed to keep to a fortnightly schedule, which I think is astonishing. When I started doing it, I thought, no, there's no way I can keep doing a fortnightly thing. The podcast is bad enough every fortnight, and of course I'm trying to do this thing Through the Biblioscope every second in between the podcast episodes.
Right, yeah. In the off week.
But when I started doing it, I didn't think I would be able to keep it going really for very, very long at that sort of rate. But when I started doing it, I started looking for things like new releases, what books are coming up or what announcements are being made about new things that are coming out. And there's so much material out there. There's so many new books and so on that are coming out I can't possibly keep up with that. What I can do is to choose one or two or three books each fortnight to say, look, these books are books I would like to read. Other people who have a similar taste to me might like to read too. And I also include in my fortnightly thing, which is an email newsletter, I should say. I haven't said that so far. It's just something which turns up in your inbox every fortnight. And the other thing I'm including in there is just what I'm currently reading, a bit of a summary of what I'm currently reading, short reviews of things I've finished reading. And it's just, I like the frequency of it in the sense that it's very topical. If something comes up like that interview between Neil Gaiman and Susanna Clarke, for example, or the fact that she's just won that prize, there are things I could talk about which are very topical in that newsletter. So I think there's scope for it. I think with any of these things, it takes a long while to build up an audience to get traction. And to spread it out beyond the sort of group of friends who sort of are loyal to you and say, oh, well, David's doing something, we better support him in doing it, and relatives and so on. But so it does take quite a while to get out beyond that group. But I think just if I keep on doing it on a regular sort of basis, that I will be able to do that and get a bit more audience. And I say it's just, I have so much material. That's what it comes down to. I have so much material. Not just the current reading, but stuff that goes way, way, way back. So I've been doing this for a long, long time, writing these shortish reviews of books. I've got so much material I could include that I can easily feed it with that kind of material. And so that's the thinking. So we'll see how we go. So far, it's been fun. I've been enjoying doing it, and I haven't found it very hard to do. So we'll see how we go from there. So I'll put a link in the show notes, obviously, as I will for Perry's thing, but you can click there and decide whether you want to subscribe. It doesn't cost you anything, it's free, and you can get it in your inbox every fortnight or so.
That's the major thing about the fanish community that we're talking about here with these small magazines or fanzines, as we call them, is that they're generally free. If you get them as a PDF version, people aren't going to charge you money for them. There may be some around that do because they want to do them on a printed version only, and their printing costs are quite high, as I alluded to earlier. But in general, they're free.
Oh, well, that's been fun talking about those things. And then the other thing we thought we might talk about, because we've been talking about the Hugo nominees for the short fiction of the last few episodes. We've done the novella, we've done the novelettes, we've done the short stories. The one big thing we've left out so far is the novels that have been nominated for this year's Hugo Awards. So we thought we might start doing those, do a couple of those each episode maybe, and we'll get through those before the awards are decided.
That sounds like a good idea. We've already discussed one of these at length, Piranesi, which has already been nominated, and we've given that a fair bit of traction here. I think we can. Well, would I be okay to say to you, David, that we would both be thinking at this point that would be our pick, given that it's the only one prior to this week, it was the only one that we had actually read. Mm-hmm. So that would be the one that we were going to be choosing. And we'll just see how the others go in relation to that, because that would be our benchmark, would you think?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to compare apples with oranges, really, and I think that Piranesi is such a different sort of take on the SF / fantasy genre that it's a bit hard to compare. It's interesting. We'll see how we go anyway. Certainly, it would still be my pick, but I wouldn't be disappointed if the other books, the other novel I've read so far out of the nominees were to win. I wouldn't be hugely disappointed. But that's only two books out of, what is it, six?
Six. Unfortunately, the nature of voting for these types of awards is that you really do have to check. You have to compare one against the other, all the others, and determine which of those you want to give your first, second, third, and fourth, and so on, preferences to. And it's just the nature of the beast. We have to basically get to that point. And we're not going to necessarily agree all the way down the track, but that's the fun of the whole process about talking about books. You don't have to agree with everything somebody says.
No, yeah.
The major thing to do is just to get a different perspective, and maybe you might actually come across a book that you hadn't thought of reading before, but the way somebody looks at it will be enough to give you the pointer to go out and find it and have a read of it. So do you want me to start off?
Yeah, if you start,
shall
that'd
I?
Be good.
Okay. Yeah. I'll start with a novel by Martha Wells called Network Effect. Now, this is, like all of these, was published in 2020. As the Hugo Awards are coming in so late this year, there's been a number of other awards in the genre that have already been announced. And this one looks like it's doing well because it's already won the Nebula and Locus SF Awards for Best Novel for this particular year. So that's a fair pointer that some people think this one's pretty good.
Maybe the favourite, yep.
You'd have to think so if it picked up those two, but let's go into it and have a bit of a look at it. Now, this particular book is the fifth entry in the author's Murderbot Diary series, and I'll explain what all that means in a minute. Though this is the first full-length novel. All the previous entries in this particular series have been novellas. There's been a couple of short stories as well, but I'm not going to cover those because I'm only looking at things as being published as a whole, and the novellas that have been printed so far have all been done by Tor.com and have all been published and printed as one volume. I mean, there might only be 120-odd pages or thereabouts for the novella, but they're a single entity, and that's why I've taken them as an entry in this particular series. This novel is the first full-length novel, and it's about 280 pages on my e-book version. So decent length without being so totally off the planet that, you know, you'll never get through it. Now, the previous novellas in this particular series were All Systems Red in 2017, and then three in 2018, Artificial Condition, Rogue Protocol, and Exit Strategy. The first of these, All Systems Red, won the Hugo, Nebula, and Locus Awards for Best Novella for that year. So more of a track record. And the second also won the Hugo and Locus Awards. So it's already a fairly well-regarded series right from the very beginning. So worth having a look at, I think. Now, the narrator of this series is a security unit. So the way this particular season, this series goes, the author basically cuts down the titles of these things and calls it a SEC unit, so short for security unit. But it calls itself a murder bot. Now, this is a constructed being. It's part human organic material and part machine. So in other words, it would be what would have been called ages ago a cyborg, although I don't remember that term ever being used in this particular novel. It may have appeared in some of the novellas, but I read those some time ago and I can't remember every word that I read in them, but basically it's a cyborg. So it's an amalgamation of metal, like as a robot, but with parts of it as a human being. So it's got a sort of skin muscular overlay over the top of a metal infrastructure underneath. Now, prior to first novella in this particular series, the SEC unit had hacked and disabled its governor module, which meant that that's put in place for these cyborgs so that they basically don't go off and do whatever they want. They actually are there to obey the orders of the humans around them. Now, for whatever reason, this particular unit decided that it was going to hack its module and override it and disabled it, which it did. And so now it's become an autonomous entity, but it still harbors some feeling of loyalty to its human companions, and does all it can to provide the security that they need, because that's basically what it's been employed for. It's a fighting machine, if you like. It's there to ensure that the group of humans that it sticks around and looks after is protected, and it will do whatever it needs to do, right up to self-sacrifice, to ensure that the humans are kept safe wherever they are. Now, most of the time, well, the one thing about this particular SEC unit that makes it different from everybody else or all the others, we don't really know terribly much about them other than the fact that there are a few of them around, but they are just sort of straight sort of robotic cyborgs, is that this one's got a real love of long-running, unrealistic soap operas. It actually likes to sit and watch inside its own head soap operas, which it's downloaded off various networks when it travels around the galaxy. Now, this whole series of stories is set in a far, far future galaxy where the human race is basically spread out all the way pretty much right around the galaxy, wherever it can. And it's gone through a phase of corporations finding suitable planets and trying to terraform them, that is, to change them into an Earth-like environment. Things started off way back when, from the book's perspective, but in the future for us, where the galactic exploration was undertaken with slow boats, so long-haul generation ships that sort of took forever to get out to the planet and then did what they needed to do when they got there to terraform it, to make it suitable for human habitation. By the time we get to this particular series, there's been wormhole technology which has been invented or implemented so that everybody can jump around wherever they like in hyperspace. Now, we all know that this is at the moment completely fallacious and, you know, just magical, if you like. But it's a common theme and meme in the science fiction world. So we just basically go with it. It's the Star Trek going up through warp speed, hacking through a wormhole, coming out the other end. Now, things don't work. You can't travel from one spot on in the galaxy to another instantaneously. There's got to be, for this particular in this particular series, there's got to be some travel time between one point and another. That can sometimes be a major plot point, and it is a little bit in this particular book, but not a great one, but it is actually there. So anyway, so what happens is that this particular SEC unit is picking up its understanding of human behaviours by watching these soap operas, and it would always rather be doing this rather than listening to somebody yakking at it. And there are times when you have the SEC unit, because they're all written from in a first person from this particular SEC unit's point of view. So it's telling you the story of itself, and it will tell you that this human's basically busily talking to it, and it's getting bored, and it doesn't want to basically sit there and listen to this, but it will because it has to. So in the background, it's running a episode 157 of Sanctuary Moon or some other soap opera that it's got that it really likes. And it just goes back over and over and over watching these things, whatever it feels like. So that's a nice little piece that it has for this particular series. Now, so that's the background. In this particular novel, the Murderbot's providing security for research expedition. Oh, by the way, I should tell you that all the humans refer to it as SecBot. They don't refer to it as Murderbot. That would not be actually terribly good. That's the name it gives itself because it's trying to be, you know, big and tough and strong and build itself up. So it's just acting like a human, really, just trying to make itself, you know, bigger than it actually is, but it only refers to itself as a security unit to the humans. It doesn't tell anybody else what its real name is. Maybe some of the other AIs that it comes in contact with, but that's about it. Anyway, so this Murderbot is providing security for a research expedition that includes the daughter and the brother-in-law of the woman that first engaged it in All Systems Red way back in the beginning of this particular series, and for whom it holds the highest regard. It basically has always been working with this woman on and off or going where it has... where this particular woman, Dr. Mensah, has sent it. So it's got a whole lot of regard for it. As this expedition spaceship is travelling through space, it's attacked by a hostile transport vessel. And while the rest of the crew escape in a lifeboat, the Murderbot and Dr. Mensah's daughter, Amina, are forced to board this vessel that they have come into contact with. They basically were trying to get across there because they got stuck, and that was the only way they could go to basically, otherwise they're going to be stuck out in space everywhere, and you don't last too long out there. And so what they then find out is that during a subsequent hyperspace travel, the Murderbot is able to work out where it is, and he suddenly realises that it's been on this particular ship before and recognises it. But when it tries to contact the controlling AI, it's not getting any information back from it at all. It doesn't seem to be there. And this was a friend of the Murderbot's earlier, and it's really quite distressed about this. And so it decides that it's going to take control of this particular ship. Now, there's about 8 or 10 other humans. I say humans because they've been sort of altered by some contact with some alien life forms. There's 8 or 10 humans on here, on this particular ship, who are trying to stop the Murderbot from taking control of the ship, as you would expect. Now, there's a very... In this part of the book, which is really quite early, we're only about sort of 40, 50 pages into this particular book when this particular sequence starts. And it's a long, complex and very well orchestrated military operation that it undertakes with inside the spaceship, trying to protect its human companion, but also to take control of what's going on and to work out what happened to the AI that was there that it used to know. Excellent piece of work, this. Really quite well done. It's very... It's one of those pieces, David, that every now and again you read a book and you think somebody should actually put a note up on top of it saying, it is best that you read this next 60 pages in one hit. Okay. Do not stop reading this bit. Just get into it and just go all the way right through. I would have done it by basically putting it into one big long chapter, but the author's broken it up a bit, probably because they probably thought 60 or 80 pages in one chapter was too long. I don't. I think that this bit in this section should have... needs to be read all in one big hit because it's frenetic. It really goes, and it's fantastic stuff. It really moves along. And so, as you would expect, because that's about 60 or 80 pages, you're only halfway through the book, and you think, well, obviously the Murderbot's going to come through this. Yes, it does. I can tell you that much.
Of course.
But it's how it gets there and how it does it, which is the most interesting thing. And so then the rest of the novel joins up the Murderbot and Amina with the other part of the crew that theoretically tried to get off on the lifeboat, but found themselves stuck onto the transport vessel anyway. They all get reunited, and then they find themselves in a orbiting a planet in a solar system that they don't know where they are, and they don't know what's going on and what's happening. And so they have to try and work out who tried to attack them and why, what they can do about it, what they can do to try to rectify the situation, and what they can do to try to get everybody back home safe. I thought this was I really like this series. It sort of fits into that sort of subgenres of military flavored space opera, but it's all done on a personal level. So it's not big battleships having explosions in space. This is more down on a personal level. Doesn't go into a lot of blood, guts and gore, but you know there's a lot of people getting hurt, quite a lot. But it's not that bad. And I think it'll appeal to fans of any of those subgenres of SF or just basically who are interested in this particular character, because this Murderbot is one of the major characters of modern science fiction, in my view, and it's worth watching how it develops and how it goes through. If you come to this particular novel first up, you're probably going to be a bit nonplussed early on about what's going on. I would suggest that the best thing to do is to read the first of the novellas. And then if you like those, keep on reading the novellas, but if you can't get access to them or you don't have them, then to go from that novella and then read this particular novel, and then you'll have a better idea of what the Murderbot is, what its reasons for doing what it does, what those reasons are and why it does it, and the way that it's trying to figure out what it's become and what it's going to do next. I really like this. I like this a lot. I would not be at all surprised if this picks up the Hugo. It could very easily do that. It's been getting a lot of good reception all the way across the field. I think, it's a good one. It's a good one.
Probably the one to put your money on if you're a betting person, yeah?
I probably would put my money on this one if I was a betting person. At this stage, I mean, if we're going to go along and say, hey, which one am I going to vote for? At this stage, Piranesi, to me, is still a better book on the basis that I just found it really, really interesting. And I'm going to be a bit like you, David, and have to go back and reread it again. I know you were saying that you were reading it for the third time. I'm going to have to go back and read it for the second time just to pick up those bits I missed because I think that one's worth doing. At some stage or other, I think I'll probably come back to this particular book as well by picking up all of the novellas and reading all those right through when things get further down the track again. I may need to do that if she keeps on putting out more novellas or novels in this series just to keep up to work out what's going on, because there's another novella after this novel which was published this year which will be eligible for an award next year. But I would commend Network Effect by Martha Wells to you.
Okay, thank you. Indeed. All right, well, the one that I'm going to look at is called The Relentless Moon by Mary Robinette Cowell. Now, this is the third book in the, quote, Lady Astronaut series by this author, the first being The Calculating Stars, which won both the Nebula and Hugo Awards for Best Novel in 2018. So the premise of the series is quite an interesting one. It's an alternate history in which a massive meteor strikes the eastern United States in 1952. It causes terrible and widespread damage. It destroys the cities of New York, Boston, and Washington, among many others. And what's worse, it appears to trigger irreversible climate change, which within about a century will result in runaway global warming, which will ultimately see the oceans begin to boil. Now, as a response, seeking a way to continue human civilization, America joins with other countries to put their efforts into developing space travel. But this is all still in the 1950s, so it's all based on technology similar to the real space race. So you've got, you know, the sort of the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and I guess Soyuz and Vostok kind of technology as well, that sort of time. So as an alternative history, it's got many similarities to the Apple TV Plus series For All Mankind, particularly the early involvement of women astronauts in the program. But it's a different spin on the same idea, I suppose. I kind of need to go back over the previous books in the series before I start talking about the one I'm going to talk about today. So in The Calculating Stars, the first-person protagonist is Emmy York, who's a former Air Force pilot who tested and ferried aircraft during the Second World War. And a very strong theme throughout the whole series, really, is the fight by women for recognition and respect as able pilots and later, you know, able and capable astronauts. Well, in fact, really, it's recognition and respect for as being competent human beings, which wasn't taken for granted in those days by any means. And a parallel and equally strong theme is the same continuing fight by people of colour to overcome racism and to be respected on their own terms. So Emma finally makes it into the astronaut corps and achieves fame from her appearance on a television show as the Lady Astronaut, a label which sticks with her and which the agency loves as good PR. She's not so fond of it. So the first book ends up just as Emmy York is finally launched into space on a mission to the moon. It's the equivalent of Apollo 11 in our history. Emma, though, is not destined to walk on the moon, but to be the command pilot, you know, the Michael Collins role, while men do the actual landing. You know, they still see the sexism running. And the second book in the series, The Fated Sky, moves on to the first mission to Mars. And through a series of unexpected events, Emma York finds herself included in the crew of this expedition. Racism and misogyny still run strong, though, and cause serious problems on this mission. There's a long-running, extremely well-handled, I thought, personal conflict between Emma York and Stetson Parker, who's the mission commander. And also there's the presence of a white South African, and along with black American astronauts. And that adds even more tension, because this, of course, is still in the era of apartheid. And again, this book is a very interesting book. It's got a good tense plot, but it ends just before the actual landing on Mars. So now we come to the third book in the series, The Relentless Moon, which is up for the best novel this year in the Hugos. And this is the one I'm actually supposed to be talking about, so let's move on to that. So this one has a different first-person protagonist because it runs parallel in the same time period as the mission to Mars. And there are continuing links between the story in this novel and the events in the preceding one. So the protagonist here is Nicole Wagin, one of the early women astronauts, who is now the wife of the governor of Kansas. And she's on frequent rotation to the small but now permanent settlement on the moon. And the space program is, however, threatened by an extremist group calling themselves Earth First. And this group threatens violent reprisals against those involved in the space program, arguing that even if it succeeds in establishing outposts of humanity on the moon and Mars, millions will be left on Earth as it becomes uninhabitable. And of course, those millions are likely to be the powerless, the marginalized, and it's all true, of course, so they have a point. But they're a very violent group, and they're responsible for a series of incidents of sabotage of rockets and space equipment, including some of the equipment on the Mars mission, which plays out in the previous book. So Wagin is sent back to the moon to secretly investigate problems there, and she quickly finds herself in danger due to the efforts of an Earth-first saboteur who is trying to close down the base. But not only that, complicating the story even more, there's an outbreak of polio, which runs rampant through the small group of astronauts. And it's, when you look back at the time period, polio was endemic at the time, and vaccines were only just becoming available. So Wagin races to identify the saboteur, who they call Icarus, and she also has to try to survive the ongoing sabotage that this person's causing. Worse still, she's constantly struggling throughout the book with anorexia, which becomes worse the more stressed she becomes, and of course she gets pretty stressed. And now this internal struggle I thought was very convincing, and I get the impression that anorexia is something either of which the author has had some personal experience, or she's talked to a number of people who have suffered from anorexia. It's very convincing, from the first-person point of view of how this person rationalizes not eating and how they struggle to force themselves to eat and so on. It's very, very well done, I thought. So, look, I like this one a lot, even more than the other novels I've read in the series so far. It's more exciting and tense than those ones, I thought. A bit of a stronger plot. And the author's clearly done a lot of very solid research into the technology of the time. She lists all the people she's spoken to and all the books she's read and so on. And similarly, not just the technology, but the health issues like polio and so on, and the politics of the time. And all of that she documents at the back of the book. And I think she's really excellent at depicting these interpersonal relationships and the personal issues involved with the characters. So, yeah, I would recommend this. I've only read two books so far out of the nominees for the Hugo this year. And although, as we've said, we're probably still both vote for Piranesi, I wouldn't be disappointed if this one were to win the Hugo instead. I don't know whether it's worth noting that Cowell is currently the president of the SFWA, the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and I believe she's also been working very closely with this year's World SF Convention, DISCON, to help them out in various ways. Is that right?
Well, actually, she's taken over as chair of the convention.
Oh, there you go.
So they've brought her in to help smooth over all the problems they were having right across the board. So that seems to be working because the number of incidents coming out in a newsworthy phase has died away completely. So it looks like things have settled down and that this particular convention will go ahead quite successfully. Hmm. But she's a very interesting author. I read the first one of these that was published a couple of years back, so the one that won the Hugo. I read that. It sounds like this third one is a better novel than that first one, which is not always that common in a series.
No,
you normally find out that first one strong, second one not so strong. It's sort of the bridging novel, and the third one's not quite as good as the first one. But if this one's quite strong, that's good stuff. Do you see this as being an ongoing series? Do you think that?
Yeah, I believe there's a fourth book already in the works. So,
okay.
which again is focused on Mars. It's based on the title. So that's interesting.
Okay, yeah, well, I think that's one thing that we're going to find is quite a common theme amongst the nominees for the novel for this year in the Hugos, that most of them are either part of a series or start of a series, except for Piranesi, unless...
Oh, no, that's not part of a series, I shouldn't
think. No, you didn't get anything out of the conversation from between her and Gaiman?
She did talk about her next book, though, which is very interesting. It sounds, you know, she gave very few details away, but it sounds very interesting because a large part of it is set in Bradford, Yorkshire, which is my hometown, Perry. Yeah, so that'll be interesting. And
so you're salivating over this one.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see what she comes out with.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good. So at least, well, the one good thing about knowing that is that you hear that Susanna Clarke is actually back writing again.
Back writing, yeah.
So hopefully that those health problems that she had for such a long period of time that, you know, sort of basically forced her to stop writing between Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell and Piranesi, which is what, 15 years?
14 years, yeah.
14 years. Mm. That's a long period to be off your game, really. Mm. And to come back so strongly with the book that she did is fantastic, but also good to hear that she's going to be writing other stuff.
Indeed.
And, look, she could do a sequel to Piranesi. Wouldn't bother me. They can go somewhere else.
Shouldn't they say
go through another portal.
So. Shouldn't think so. No.
Anyway, I enjoyed that one a lot. And so, look, so, well, that's good, actually, because that means there's three there that we've looked at so far.
Yep.
The Cow, the Wills, and the Clark, that all sound like they are...
Worthy nominees, yeah.
Worthy nominees, decent novels. You can't say that all the time for every year in a Hugo Award, that's for sure. We've had some years that we've been looking at in the 1960s.
Mm.
Remember, there was a Lensman book, there was an Edgar Rice Burroughs book,
right,
that was nominated,
terrible,
and you think,
terrible.
What the hell? You know, there were much, much better books around than those that could have been nominated, but this year, at least with those first three, that sounds pretty strong.
Mm.
So that's good. That's good. I'm looking forward to reading that one then. I will actually have to read the second in the series and then the third pretty much close
together. I had to do that. So I've actually read the two, the Fated Sky and the Relentless Moon. I read them all in the last week.
All right.
Last week.
So not a bad idea to read them quite close together.
Yeah, and I would certainly read them in that order, because The Relentless Moon has spoilers, if you like, for the previous book. If you hadn't read the previous book, then you'd find the things that you didn't want to know before the end of it.
All right, and you'd be slightly disappointed, so better off reading it in sequence. As it was published.
Yep.
Okay. Oh, that's good then. That's all right. Mm. So next time we do this, which might not be next... No, I don't think it's going to be
next week. Next time we're going to do crime.
Crime fiction, I think. Mm. Yes, I think next time we're going to be dealing with some crime fiction that we've been reading recently, which will give us time to catch up on the other novels that are on the Hugo ballot. We won't finish it all. I think the idea of doing one in depth each time sounds like a good approach.
Mm.
And we'll have a look at those, and we'll be finished them well before voting, which is still some time off. I think voting finishes mid-November or somewhere around there. So yeah. I've got plenty of time to catch up, thank God. All right, so we will be talking about crime fiction next time.
Yep.
And that's about it then.
Probably does us for the day. We've gone to the hour long.
Gone to the hour, so I think that's pretty good. Okay, David, so we shall talk again in a fortnight.
Indeed. Thanks, Barry.
See you then.
See you then.